history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are people around you who've done pretty remarkable things on our behalf, and we might never know about it unless we ask a few questions and take that time to listen. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget that price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we journey down that path, we learn a lot. We're always educated, we are entertained, and often we really are inspired, almost always by members of what's been called America's greatest generation. Those men and women who served in World War II, and in spending so much time with that generation over the years, we've heard a few eye-opening things. Sometimes they'll tell us they think their parents, the ones who lived through World War I and endured the Great Depression, then raised them into the young Americans who would help win World War II, that generation before them was the greatest. Then sometimes we hear the empathy that our World War II vets have for the generation that followed them. For so many, it was their sons who signed up or were drafted to go risk their lives and sometimes sacrifice their lives in Vietnam. And we're going to take a little detour and focus on that Vietnam generation today because of an upcoming event that any Vietnam veteran listening right now is not only invited to attend for free, but heartily and sincerely encouraged to attend as well. It will be a little easier for those of you who are listening to our program today in California because this event's going to be right smack dab in the middle of the Golden State on Saturday, April 28th. It's designed to be the welcome home our Vietnam veterans never received, and it'll be in Fresno, California, in a baseball stadium that's home to the AAA Fresno Grizzlies of the Pacific Coast League. You can find links to all the information you're going to hear today at hometownheroesradio.com or on the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But let's hear it first from the woman in whose heart this idea was hatched, Denise Baronian.
So April 28th is a day that we're going to right a wrong in our American history. We are wanting to bring our Vietnam veterans and give them an opportunity to experience that hero's welcome home that they never received when they came home from the Vietnam War.
So where does this come from? Where did this idea originate?
Actually, I'm married to a Vietnam veteran. We've been married for 31 years, and I myself don't remember a whole lot about the Vietnam War, but hearing his stories over the years and connecting with some of his friends that are also Vietnam veterans, I just started hearing this theme emerge of just being not only going through a very difficult time in the war, but it was kind of a double whammy coming home from the war and experiencing abuse here in our own country. And it just broke my heart over the years. And so this idea started that we needed to do something to make it right and give them their hero's welcome home.
Well, it's one thing to have an idea, and it's another thing to have an event like this come together. So how long have you been thinking about this, working on this, working toward what's going to happen April 28th?
So I saw a video on the internet that inspired me. It was filmed at Fort Campbell in Kentucky. And they had done it on a very small scale. I tried to think about ways to make this happen, and that kind of was in the back of my mind for about, I would say, 5 years. And then we hired a veteran recruiter here at Fresno Pacific University, and I decided to kind of pitch the idea because he knew people in the military, and I thought could perhaps get me connected. And he ran with it. He loved it. He is a veteran himself. His father was a Vietnam veteran and has since passed away. And so it's something that was really near and dear to his heart, and he connected with some amazing veteran business owners in the community, and we just got together and went from there.
So what's the latest? What's going to happen on the 28th specifically? And if people are hearing about this for the first time, how can they help you? How can they be a part of it?
Thank you for asking that. On April 28th at 4:30, we'll be bringing the veterans in. We'll be doing the Heroes Welcome Home. There'll be some speeches and bands and banners and flags, and we'll give them that initial celebration. And then there'll be a time where we will actually take the veterans out onto the baseball field prior to a Grizzlies baseball game starting. Grizzlies has partnered with us to do this event, and so we're able to tag it on to one of the baseball games. We're also going to have 144th Fighter Wing flyover. Fresno State has also donated their Bulldog Blitz all-female parachute team that's going to be coming onto the field with the POW and American flag. We've also designed a commemorative challenge coin for the Vietnam veterans that we'll be handing to them out as they enter onto the field. And we've got some additional things that are special surprises. We're going to have some kiosks set up and some great guests and speakers and vocalists and all kinds of things. So we're excited, very excited.
And how many Vietnam veterans do you think are going to be there? How many can you accommodate?
We can accommodate as many as we can get there. The stadium itself holds about 14,000. And so we have an area reserved for 1,000. If we fill that area, Grizzlies will give us another area. So we would love to fill the stadium. We have no idea yet how many are coming, but we're just opening up the invitation and just praying that people get the word out. All of us either know a Vietnam veteran or know somebody that knows a Vietnam veteran. So we just want to really encourage people to get the word out for us and help us.
So if a Vietnam veteran wants a ticket to this celebration or this game, what's it going to cost them?
So for Vietnam veterans and a guest, it will be free. So each Vietnam veteran will get 2 free tickets. In addition to any widows that have lost their spouse that was a Vietnam veteran, they too can come in for free. Everyone else, Grizzlies has given us a special price of $10. That includes the welcome home ceremony and a Grizzlies baseball game. Everything starts at 5 o'clock. The game starts at 7, and the ticket includes all of that. So there is a website they can go to get their tickets, or they can go to the Grizzlies box office. But if they go to our Facebook page at WHVVCA, or go to our website at WHVVCA.com and just click on buy tickets, it will take them directly to the portal. And veterans, type in the code veterans. And this is again for Vietnam veterans. Type in the code veterans and they'll get their 2 free tickets.
So if a Vietnam veteran's listening right now in San Diego or Monterey or San Luis Obispo or Santa Maria or even maybe out of state, they can go onto that website and get 2 free tickets.
Absolutely. All Vietnam veterans come in free. And it doesn't matter where they're coming from. They can come from anywhere in the United States and they'll get those 2 free tickets. We want to make sure that we make it easy for them to come in. This is their time to be honored, celebrated. We don't want them to have to worry about any of that.
So whether you end up with 1,000 veterans there or 10,000 Vietnam veterans there, what's the number one message that you want them to hear, or what's the experience that you hope they have that day?
I think talking to my husband really summed it up for me. He said this, even though he's a Vietnam veteran and he's proud of me for doing this and honored to be celebrated, he said this is really about those that didn't get to come home. And so we want to recognize those that come, but there are those that are that were POWs, MIAs, those that are, there's over 1,600 still unaccounted for. This is also for them, and we just want to make sure. Our theme is to honor, to heal, and to educate. And I think this opportunity is to teach those that don't know a lot about the Vietnam War, and to provide a time for our Vietnam veterans to come together for healing, and to just know that regardless of what they experienced when they came home, they're in a country now that loves them and supports them, and want to thank them for their immense sacrifice. And not only them, but their families, because they paid a huge price as well. So it's to acknowledge all of them. In order to do this, we do have a GoFundMe page that we're asking businesses and our friends to help get the word out with the GoFundMe page. And that's at GoFundMe.com and WHVVCA. It's just so that we can offer this to our veterans and not have to worry about the expense. So we're trying to get enough donations to cover that.
So if they go to the GoFundMe page and donate, they're offsetting the cost of those free tickets for Vietnam vets.
Yes. And every penny that gets donated, whether it's through a sponsorship or whether it's through GoFundMe, it goes directly into AmVets, who has partnered with us as well. So if there's any monies left over at all, one penny, it will go back to AmVets, so it stays with the veteran community to help our veterans.
And I know we would all love to see the response overcome the need and then some. And speaking of AmVets, the state director for that organization in California is Smokey Rickard. We're going to hear some of what he experienced as a fighter pilot in Vietnam. But before we get to that, Smokey, tell me why this event on April 28th is so important.
When I got called by David and Denise and said, would you like to be a part of this? Welcome home, Vietnam. And a little bit about what happened and why it's coming about, it was like, wow, yeah, I would like to. especially after the VA had done something a little bit similar to that in ceremonies in 2015 when they held a big welcome home commencement. There was like 550, 600 veterans that showed up, and I was asked to say a few words and also be there at the time. And being able to shake each one of those 550, 600 individuals' hands. And there were some individuals there I hadn't seen since high school, which was over 50 years ago. It was very rewarding. There was a lot of tears. It was a lot of at ease, a little bit of more kind of a peace. And it was like finally being recognized after all these years of doing it then. So I think the same thing will happen. I think there will be a lot of individuals that there will be a lot of tears. There'll be a lot of stuff that people want to say or individuals want to say, families want to say because of what's been happening for all these years after coming back from overseas. So it doesn't make any difference what war, it doesn't make any difference what conflict, or even currently. When an individual leaves and goes over away from home and return, the individual is always different. He or she is never the same. And no matter how much, because they're experiencing stuff that you've never been really prepared for. And when you return, your husband or wife is not the same. So I'm excited about this and being able to shake a lot of the guys' hands and the girls' hands and be able to say, welcome home and thank you for your service and thank you for your support. It meant a lot to me, and I know it'll mean a lot to a lot of other people.
Well, and it seems especially for this generation specifically that this is an important step that needs to be taken. And I spend so much of my time talking to guys older than you, guys who served in World War II. And a lot of times when we take them back to Washington, D.C. on these honor flights, some of them are more moved by the Vietnam Wall and seeing all those names than they are by the memorial to their own generation. And they feel so badly for the Vietnam generation for what they endured when they came home, or even as they were overseas, what was happening back home. I know you experienced some of this personally, and we're going to talk about that, but just in your work with AMVETS and dealing with so many Vietnam veterans, how needed is something like this for the wounds that these men carry around on a daily basis?
You know, I think it's really, really necessary because, again, a lot of them came back. A lot of the Vietnam veterans came back. They left the service and walked away. And from there, ever since that time, they've always felt kind of a mixture of, wait a minute, I only did what was right and what I was told to do by our government. We in order to fight, that's what we were told to do. We're protecting. And now we come back, and it's kind of like we're being told to change our uniforms before you go off base or before you leave the gates. And then also seeing and hearing what was going on, people didn't see you as a military person. They see you civilian clothes. They don't understand. So there's a lot of consternation going on. And there's been a lot of consternation for many, 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 many years of fighting this. I only did what I thought I was supposed to be doing, what I was told to do, versus that's not me, and I didn't do all that stuff that they said they were doing. So I think they're just waiting for a pat on the back and somebody saying, you're okay. You did okay. You did what you were supposed to be doing, and that we're sorry that, you know, what happened to you, but you are okay, and you did great, and thank you for your service. So I think there's a lot of it. It still needs to be a finishing point of saying, welcome home. You did everything right. And thank you for serving, and thank you for coming home alive. And I think also over this period of time, I think there's so much mental anguish that the family members have went through, the wives has went through. You know, I think if there's any way that they can get see their husbands to be relieved or feel a little bit different, maybe it will change how the relationship is, or maybe what has been happening in the past. Maybe they'll see something in the future that's a different person than what they have been living with. So I really think it's really, really important having something like this. And I mean, to continue this, as a matter of fact, I know that President Obama had sent a declaration, and it was like between 2015, I believe it was, until 2025, that these ceremonies and stuff will continue over a period of time to be able to get the word out and to be able to get some finishing touches to a lot of these individuals, what they've been going through.
Yeah, and those, I guess, 50th anniversary commemorations will continue on into the future. And for this one-time event, I mean, we don't know how many veterans are going to be there, whether there's 500 like the event you were talking about, or 5,000. I mean, they're hearing this right now in San Diego and on the Central Coast and in Northern California and even in other states. And all those veterans have the chance to come and be a part of this, free tickets to the ball game, of course, and this ceremony. If there's one thing you would want your fellow Vietnam veterans to hear, to understand, to go away from that event with? What would that one thing be?
Knowing that everything that you did was right, and that our government should have stood up and said, welcome home, just like we're doing now. But knowing that you didn't do anything wrong. You just did what we were told to do as young kids over there in Vietnam, serving our country, doing and helping what we felt was right for our country over there, so it would never, ever come back here in the States.
Well, I also want to hear some of what you did over there in Vietnam. And after all, that's what our Hometown Heroes listeners are used to hearing on this program. But right now, it's time for our first commercial break. Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans is the event all Vietnam vets are invited to. Wherever you're listening right now, if you can make it to Fresno, California on April 28th, they're going to have two free tickets for you. Pull up that info at whvvca.com or just go to hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this.
Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Effler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank, it's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly a quarter million EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight.
Nearly 1,000 veterans have gotten to see their memorials for free
because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a different focus today as we try to get the word out about a chance for Vietnam veterans to receive the welcome home they never experienced a half century ago. That event will take place before a AAA baseball game in Fresno, California on April 28th. Any Vietnam veteran can get two free tickets, and that also applies for widows of Vietnam vets who have left us as well. I know there were times when Smokey Rickard wondered if he was going to leave his wife in that tragic position as he flew 288 combat missions in the skies over Vietnam. But why don't we start growing up in Central California, Smokey? Did you always know you were going to be a pilot?
You know, as a kid, you have a lot of aspirations, and one of those was being a pilot. But, you know, being a country boy and living on a ranch, all I ever thought that, I would grow up on the ranch and possibly go into agriculture, which is a great, great profession. And so I thought I was going to do that. I did play ball in high school, and then fortunately, I was able to play ball in college. And I was doing that, I thought, boy, what'd be great. I enjoy coaching, helping younger kids as I was growing up. So I thought, well, maybe one of these days I would be a coach. But no, when you're growing up, you never experienced or even thought that. And even though we were living close to Castle and Navy Lamar, no, there was never an idea that I would ever be a pilot.
Did you think you were going to be a pro football player?
Growing up as a kid, you always hoped that you had that quality. But as I got older, I didn't think I would ever be a pro football. I was looking for baseball. But at the same time, baseball and football was my two areas that I really loved. But as I was going forward, then with the draft coming in, it kind of stopped everything, you know, later on. So at that particular time, life ceased, kind of like stopped back in the 69 type frame when it says you're going to have to go in the military. It's kind of like, whoa, wait a minute. I hadn't planned on that.
Well, let's talk about that because, I spent a lot of time talking to World War II veterans. For all of them, it was December 7th, 1941, it changed the world. And of course, they had a draft even before that, and guys knew they were going to be a part of this. So you're coming up in the 60s, you play college football for the Fresno State Bulldogs, and I'm sure you're planning your life out, right? You're saying, I'm going to do this and this and this and this. When did you realize that, hey, you could be snatched up and have to go halfway across the world to serve your country?
When you turn 18, you wind up going down and you sign up for the draft at that particular time, selective service. And then soon after that, you went in and you wound up taking a selective service you know, physical and testing and stuff like that. And I think that became a kind of an eye-opener and stuff like that. And I had talked to my granddad who raised me, and my grandmother granddad, and he was World War I veteran. We talked. And then my dad was World War II, and we talked about that, and of course with my uncle as well. And then, you know, I went ahead and I got married. We had a child. I was going to school and playing ball. And then all of a sudden, I received a letter saying, welcome, you're in the United States. You've been drafted by the United States Army. That was really a big eye-opener at that particular time. So I went down to Madeira. That was my draft. And I said, you know, what are you doing? I'm in college. I'm married. I have a child. And they said, Snorri Smoke, you know, we're to the point now, our requirements are start taking people like you. You know, married ones and stuff like that. So I decided I'd go down, and after thinking all different ways and what people were telling me, I went down and took the test for the Air Force and the Navy, Marines. And 5 o'clock the day I was supposed to left, the next day before Army, I got a call from Air Force says, hey, you know, we have an opportunity for you. Would you accept going to Officers Candidates Training School? And then if you pass that, go on to be a pilot. And I said, a pilot? You know, I couldn't believe it. I said, absolutely, because Army had already told me that they were going to take me and put me in as a warrant officer, and I was going to be put in helicopters, and I was going to be sent to Vietnam. That's basically what they said. Mm-hmm. So I thought, well, if I'm going to be a pilot, I might well try to be a fixed-wing pilot and stuff like that. So I accepted that offer to the Air Force. So they gave me a delayed enlistment to finish my schooling. And so, I mean, that's when it kind of like everything turned away from being sports. And I knew what my life was going to be for the next few years. So I got my schooling done, and I graduated like in December, and I was in the military February.
Did you play football that fall?
No, I didn't have the opportunity. I was on the field. And then they said, hey, and I told the coach, I said, Coach, I'm sorry. I want to play, but I know what's going to happen if I don't get my schooling out of the way. So I went, got my education out of the way, and went on. So my heart was there. My heart was there all the time. But I had to think about my family, and had to think about going into the military and what was best for that. So that's when you asked me that, it was like 69 when it says everything changed. My whole life changed. So.
Well, and that's what I wanted to get at, because you think about it today, and there are people listening right now who lived through this time, and there are those who didn't, and you think about college football today. And, I mean, it's a religion for some people. It's something
amen.
You would never consider giving up this opportunity, but you were faced with that decision, and I'm sure you weren't the only guy on the team who was probably having similar concerns and thoughts. Do you remember how unsettling that time period felt?
Yeah, not only for myself, but for my wife and family. I mean, it was like, what do you mean you're going in the military? What do you mean that you're going to leave us? What do you mean that you know that you're going to wind up going over across the seas to possibly to war? It was like, what? I mean, my wife, I was 21, she was 18. And then when we had the baby, she was coming up on 20, and I was, about 22, 23 years old. And in matter of fact, when I proposed to her, I said, how would you like to be a coach's wife? And she looked at me and says, who's going to be the coach? So, I mean, yeah, I mean, from then on, it, like I said, everything just changed.
You know, it strikes me, too, one of the reasons that this has been a touchy subject for so many decades is that there was such disagreement about whether or not Americans should be over there, what they were over there for, what you were trying to accomplish. Did you have a sense of that at the time, what you were going there for, and what the mission or the overall task was?
Well, I think the main thing is you to be able to keep some type of sense to yourself and civility in you, and thinking about logic. You had to think that, first of all, you're doing what the government is telling you. You're in the military right now. The military is saying, hey, you're going to be doing this, and it's for the good of the government, the good of the country. And so you had to think like that, or if not, you would go crazy. If you had a disparity between what you're believing in and what you're doing, you would wind up driving yourself crazy. So you had to believe in what you were being told and what your commanding officers were telling you to do and going forward and what your country says. So, yeah, I think, you know, you said yes. You believed in it when you went over there, and you wound up doing the very, very best you can. Knowing that it was a way, it was, again, it was another eye-opener when you wake up one day and kind of like, you know, United States, and then you maybe go to a foreign country, and especially Vietnam, and all of a sudden you wake up and you get off that airplane and you walk out there and things are so much different. I mean, buses are now look like you know, know what, you know, with sandbags in the floor and barbed wire and wire on the side of the buses and over, you know, behind you and in the distance, you can hear artillery going off and stuff like that. You can catch yourself thinking, oh, that's just a training environment. But all of a sudden, how soon you realize it's not a training environment. And then you wake up and you say, where in the heck am I at? And how did I get here? Mm-hmm. So I think it's really a big wake-up call between just like switching on a TV and off and on. It was really big.
Well, let's talk about the missions you were flying over there. What kind of aircraft were you flying, and what was the purpose of those missions?
I was a forward air controller. I was a FAC. And the main idea of the FAC was twofold, controlling all airstrikes and air power going into South Vietnam. We would go out there and we look for strike capabilities, also for, let's say, if you want to call us, use the bad guys, and if they were coming into South Vietnam to try to stop them, to interdict them, just looking for targets like that. And we were told the rules of engagement. We were told what you would be looking for, what we could and could not do, and you had to follow those rules. And so we were looking for anything to be able to help deter the advancement from the Viet Cong and also the North NVA, North Vietnamese Northern Army. I was flying the OV-10, OV-10 Bronco. It was a twin turboprop. We carried our own ordnance. We carried rockets, and we also carried four 7.62 miniguns, two on each side. And so if we could destroy or, let's say, deter the targets, we would. If not, then we would call in the fighters and stuff like that. And then I also had an exchange program with the Navy. I had a chance to fly off the USS Kitty Hawk, and I flew 15 missions in the F-4. So we had an exchange program. Then they came and flew with me in Da Nang and Pleiku and other places like that.
And on that OV-10, what's your crew?
One person, unless you were instructing or trying to welcome another one of your pilots, kind of like that, getting them trained into the area and stuff like that. Or if you were going to do artillery adjustment with the Marines or with our naval gunfires, we'd carry a Marine in the back or a naval controller in the back, which was called a Wolfman. And in between us putting in fighters, and they were putting in naval artillery, and then when we had the fighters come on, they would stop, and we'd put in fighters, and we'd keep going back. So it was kind of like touch-and-go type things.
So in a lot of ways, you're on your own.
We are. We were.
And you're kind of the front line in the air, right? Scouting it out?
Correct. That's exactly right. We were the ones out there in the forward of everybody trying to look and check and try to find targets and be able to understand where everybody was at. So we knew that land, lay of the land, like the back of your hand. We got to the point that, I can say for myself, I became to start like playing sports. You start thinking like them, acting like them, and start thinking like them, and I started getting to the point that I became very, very good at identifying camouflage. And so from a distance, I could pick up underwater bridges or, you know, where they had their POL storage location. So, yeah, I mean, you started getting to know the land. If it changed one thing or another, you got to know. So it was interesting.
And what were the dangers you faced? I know that's a lot of missions that I'm kind of muddling together there, but in general, what were the kind of potential dangers you faced?
Well, I think, of course, several of them there. You could wind up artillery, of course, ground artillery, missiles. Those were your biggest ones. You get into areas that you maybe not see the missiles. Of course, a lot of them were heat-seeking, so you didn't see until after, corkscrew. Unless you happen to be seeing the flash or whatever the case may be. Of course, the AAA, the artillery. What scared me the worst was the fast-forward ordnance, rapid firing, like the 51 cals, 23s. But you'd still get some big ones. A lot of times they would have the AAA that would get you high, and then they'd drive you down low. And then once they got you down low, then they would try to hit you with the 23s and 51s, the smaller rapid-firing ones. And then here again, if you got down low enough, of course, too, in that area, then you're also looking for the heat-seeking Strela handheld devices that could knock you down and go into your engines, stuff like that, or any portion that would be able to seek the heat from your aircraft. It could knock you down, it could destroy you, or hit you just right, or what'll happen, you would wind up maybe with one engine less and trying to get home. So there was a lot of, the opportunity like that. Same way for your fighters when you're bringing them in. Same thing was happening to them. They would have the same concerns about being shot down that way.
Well, and as I hear you describe that, it occurs to me that you have such a strong grasp and inventory of those hazards because you probably saw each one of those hazards claim an airplane.
Yes.
Whether it was yours or somebody else's.
Yes.
And you're taken to the skies on every one of these missions knowing that you've got a wife and a child back home. How hard was that to do, to take off from one of those missions with that knowledge in the back of your head?
You really had to forget it. You really had to forget and keep your mind on what was happening because after you got down and you could thank God that you made it home okay, you wind up having to forget that you have a wife and child because it would just drive you crazy. And you got homesick. You really, really got homesick. So during that particular time, if you got your mind somewhere else and not into the game, so to speak, you could wind up, they were after you. I mean, that's what they were doing. They were after you because the forward air controllers, the Coveys, the Facs, the Rustics, the Sundogs, so there was a variety of airplanes that were doing the same thing. Some put into a lower threat area, some, the OV-10 was in the high threat area. If you wouldn't watch what you're doing, they were after you, and they would be trying to get you down. As a matter of fact, what was also ironic, they had bounties. They knew our call signs and stuff like that and got to know us just like we got to know some of them on the phone. But when they would actually pop up and start talking. But they knew us, and there was some, intel that was taken that they had big, high rewards on if you could get certain FAC or whatever down. They got paid reward. Well, whatever the reward was, I don't know.
What was your call sign?
I was Covey 566, and then we changed from 566, depending on where you flew out of. I was 566, Covey 266, and then we just dropped it later on, just was 66.
But you would have the enemy find your frequency
and actually speak English to you? Absolutely. We would have a conversation, if you want to call it that. And, of course, we had homing devices. Some of us had homing devices in our aircraft that home in on there. As long as we keep them keying the microphone, we could home in and know exactly where they're at and see what we could do about ending their transmission.
So what would those conversations be like? I mean, this is like trash talk on the football field or baseball diamond?
It was actually trash talk. Oh, yeah. Sometimes they really got personal because they got to know that you knew so-and-so. And there was a couple of times they would come up and they'd say, hey, Covey 66 or 566, we're going to shoot you down like we did your roommate or like we did your other Covey or whatever the case may be. And, it tried to get your name, your mind out of the game to get you to do something stupid and start not think about what's really going and get you kind of like the black widow in the web, so to speak. And there was transmissions constantly either trying to be jammed or interfered with or come on to. So even Army, Navy, and Air Force and Marines, somewhere along the line, they had a chance to talk to a few of those same ones, too.
So when you say that the enemy's trash talk included things like, we're going to do you like we did your roommate, I mean, that tells me that there were things that happened to other pilots that you knew very well. What are some of those things that you had to endure happening to the guys you had been serving with?
There was 13 individuals from my outfit while I was over there that didn't come back. Matter of fact, five of them were roommates of mine, and then one of them came back as a POW. You have to trick yourself, into thinking that, okay, Art's not here, or Bruce is not here, or Steve's not here because he went somewhere else, or he went home. Because you did grieve. You did grieve for a while. You went to a place by yourself and shed a tear, But it was really, really hard, and trying to get over it, it was very challenging, to say the least. And some of them even came back, their names or about them came back, 40 years later, when you see their family, and you didn't realize that was going to happen. No, there was several of them, and a lot of them I felt I have, still have problems with because I became the chief scheduler, and the ones that went down, I scheduled them for that mission. And so what really makes you, you know, what would happen if I hadn't put him on that particular mission? What happened if I'd have put him on another mission? Or maybe if I'd have taken a mission, that mission myself. And, you know, you start talking to yourself, you know, you start second guessing yourself. But after a while, you just have to say, you know, there's nothing you can do. You just got to go on, or it would drive you crazy.
It is a harsh reality that those of us who've never served in those conditions have a hard time truly grasping. But you're helping us out today. Time for our last break, but when we come back, a mission that left Smokey Rickard with the Distinguished Flying Cross, the Purple Heart, and a prestigious medal from the Vietnamese government as well. You might have a hard time believing he survived it. Pull up all that information about the Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans event coming up at the end of April. Any Vietnam vet is encouraged to attend. Find that at hometownheroesradio.com, and we'll be right back after this. Have you ever looked at a box of old videotapes or photos and said, one of these days I'm going to do something with those? I know the feeling. But more importantly, I found the solution at VHSmaster.com. VHS Master will take all your old VHS and 8mm tapes and reels and convert them to DVDs and digital videos, ensuring that your priceless memories will last for years to come. They'll even preserve and restore photos, slides, and audio cassettes. Go to VHSmaster.com. That's VHSmaster.com. And tell them you heard about them on Hometown Heroes.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, and a different twist, a different war today, talking Vietnam, because on April 28th, all Vietnam veterans are invited to experience that welcome home they missed out on 50 years ago. Fresno, California will be the place to be. Two free tickets for any Vietnam veteran who can be there. All that information is available at whvvca.com or link to it at hometownheroesradio.com. We've been hearing from decorated Vietnam fighter pilot Smokey Rickard, now executive director for AMVETS in California. He told us 13 men from his unit have their names inscribed on that haunting marble wall in Washington, D.C. Among the more than 58,000 names there are five who were actually Smokey's roommates at one time or another. And the reality is, Smokey came extremely close to having his name listed there. You want to tell us about that?
You know, it was, like you said, you know, how many was in that airplane, usually? And I said one. No, there was actually two. The good Lord was in the back seat. He was my co-pilot. And the reason why I say that is I had come back from a mission. I was down at Saigon at that time, which is now called Ho Chi Minh City. I just walked in from a mission, and I put my bags down. Well, all of a sudden, I heard one of our radios going just crazy. We had Army frequencies, Marine frequencies that, you know, let us know. They started hollering when they were having problems or being overrun. So I, you know, they were saying, you know, the code. And so I got on and I talked to them, and they said, yeah, we're being overrun and we need some help. And we always kept a couple airplanes completely fueled and loaded up as an emergency. So I called the commander and I said, hey, we got a call. We got to go down south. We've got a, you know, a code. And he says, Smoke, can you handle it? Because you just got through one. I said, oh, no. I said, we haven't got time. I'm going to go and I'll talk to you when I get down there. And there was some other guy, you know, some of our other guys, and there are other areas out there, but not primary for that. So I got in the airplane. I took off down there. Well, when I got down south, it was about 200 miles from Saigon towards the tip of South Vietnam down the Delta area. And I get there to the outpost, and I see the bad guys going underneath the wires, over the wires, and they kind of have a three wires perimeter fencing, and they were in a triangle type thing, and they were going under and over and stuff like that. So I wound up, keep your head down, and I, you know, loaded up, and I started going one side, down the other side, and all three sides, and, you know, there was nothing there. There was no trees or anything. It was completely clear except the bob, you know, the fencing and stuff like that, constituted wire, and how they wound up making the perimeter fences. So after about two or three runs on each side, I didn't have to do any more. I just kind of waited back, and I called and asked for fighters to come in to help take out another area. And so being there, I'm talking to the Army, letting everybody know that, hey, everything's fine now, and we're trying to calm them down. And all of a sudden, I saw, I'd run them back into the tree line, and I'm waiting, and then all of a sudden, the tree line fell, a false tree line fell. And next thing I know, they had a new piece of equipment down there. It was a quad-mounted 51 cal with Army-piercing rounds, and it was coming up, and they looked like pumpkins coming up. And I did something stupid. Like I said, falling into it. I was low and I was slow. I wasn't high and keeping my speed up. So anyway, I tried to start moving back and forth, changing my altitude, changing my direction, stuff. We called it jinking, so that maybe they wouldn't be able to hit me. Well, all of a sudden, I went one way, and then I came back, and all of a sudden, what passed my head? One of the rounds came in. Next thing I knew, it blew up inside, took all the canopy. I became blind. I couldn't see, and I hear a noise going off my ears, Pete, that the engine and everything was on fire, and I could start seeing the red lights. I thought, oh, my goodness, you know, and I got to keep my head. And I remembered that the reason I knew that I could remember how I could get away from them, because you could hear it just the shells was hit me from the tip, and I could just hear them running right down again. So I remembered that there was only one way out, and that was behind them. And so I thought the only way I can do is turn it upside down, shoot some rockets to keep their heads down, but I can't see, but I've got to do something, because if I try to run away from them or go left and right, they're going to shoot me down. So I turned it upside down, and I shot some rockets at them. As it started getting dark in the cockpit, I said, I'm pretty close to the ground. So I flipped it back over at that particular time, and as I did, I started to bring it back up. I ran into the trees. I had enough momentum to get me through the top of the trees, and I did bring tree limbs back with me. But I had enough. I was able to start. Well, they couldn't swing their guns around to be able to hit me from the rear at my 6 o'clock. So I climbed back up, and I called. Well, just within maybe 5 minutes after I called, to the other, my buddies from the other, you know, from my squadron, jumped on me, and they said, Smoke, you're going to have to jump out. You're smoking. You're burning up. And I said, no, I'm not going to jump out. I said, I'm either going to take it home, or we'll see what does happen, but I'm not going to jump out. So anyway, they said, well, what can we do? You know, and I said, I can't see. So what I need for you to do, you just let me know if I'm start on fire. I said, just let me know that I'm on fire, and then I will dive it, try to put out the flames, and I'll climb back up. And I said, my gear is down. They said, well, your gear is down. Your cockpit is completely gone. And I said, I know that. I can feel that. And I said, how far we got to go? And they said, about 200 miles. I said, okay. So I said, just let me know, and we'll keep going. Of course, the gas was running out because we had wet wings. So that's what I did all the way. And, of course, they told me several times, they said, Smoke, you got to jump out of there. And I said, no, I'm not going to bail out. So we get back to Saigon, and the ground, you know, the ATC got a hold of me, and they started guiding me, and they knew I couldn't see. So they cut me down over the runway, and they said, your gear down, and so God bless and good luck. And so I touched down, and I didn't know if the gear was going to hold, so I hit on one side gear, and it did. I did on the other side, and it did. And then I said, I just put the nose down and stepped on the brakes and stuff like that. Well, my roommate, he had heard, and he wanted to get an airplane to come help me out, and they said no. He had a Jeep, and he was right. All I see was a blur. I didn't know what it was, but it was right beside me. And when I stopped it, I was like, then that's when everything hit me. He comes running over there, and now we're taking a sniper attack. Snipers are shooting at us and stuff like that. So he gets me out. The ambulance wouldn't get there, you know, couldn't come there because they were being shot at. So he pulls me out, puts me in his Jeep, and he takes me back to the ambulance and puts me in there. So after looking back at it, it was like, thanks, God. I knew you were in my back seat. I just, you know, I don't know, you know.
We've all heard that expression, flying blind, but I think you just gave it new meaning. What does that feel like to land a plane and you literally can't see anything?
You know, you look back now, and I think one of the main things was being, you had to keep, and of course, you knew what was happening. You know, you felt yourself, you kept saying, well, that's just sweat. That's all it is. It's just sweat. And you knew what it was, but you couldn't let your mind start drifting.
It's
and you
blood had, running down your face.
Yeah, exactly. And you had to keep yourself, where am I at right now? What altitude? You had to literally be very, very, stay on track. And thank God you were a fairly good pilot to be able to do that and to be concentrating on what was happening. Because if you start getting disoriented, if you start straying off, you'd wind up crashing because you would be disoriented and you couldn't see anything. So you just had to know. And thank God, I mean, my two guys there that was on my side kept and, you know, keeping me up to breast. I mean, that really helped me out because of being able to talk. But then one of them, then also what happened, one of them took off, Tom took off, and he went back to the site when the fighters came in, and he went ahead and eliminated the threat from helping it to anybody else in that area. When you got down and your mind started thinking about what happened and laying there in the hospital and stuff like that, it was like, wow. It just like, wow. You just come tumbling down after it was all over with.
How long did it take before you could see again?
It was probably a good 2, 3, 4 days, and we were hoping everything would come about. I didn't tell my wife. Matter of fact, it was like 4 or 5 months, and I met her in R&R in Hawaii, and my roommate JD, who was with me, and we were eating one night, and of course, started having a couple of drinks, and he started telling the story about what happened and everything like that. And then all of a sudden, my wife realized he was talking about me, and he didn't know that I had not told her. Oh my goodness! Needless to say, I thought I was going through another war. But she said, "Why didn't you tell me?" I said, "I didn't want you to worry." You know, so, but, you know, at that time, I said, okay, Smoke, you're able to go home. And I said, no, I'm not going home. I'm going to stay right here and finish my tour. So I went back and continued flying and finishing my tour.
But you did receive the Purple Heart for that mission?
Yes, I did.
Any other decorations for that mission?
I got the Distinguished Flying Cross, and then there was also a silver medal that was put in. But through fire and stuff like that, there was some. But anyway, it never went through, which is fine. And then also I got the, matter of fact, I had the South Vietnamese President Van Thu to bring over, and I got the Vietnamese Cross of Gallantry with a silver star for that, helping that, because there was also Republic of Vietnam Army in there with them too. So it was one of those things. But here again, I don't know too many people that did anything for awards.
I'm not saying you did it for the awards.
No, but here again,
they gave you the awards because you saved a lot of lives, and it almost cost you yours.
Well, yes, to answer your question, yes.
And one more question on that before we talk more about your wife, who you just mentioned. What do you think would have happened to you if you listened to your buddies and you had bailed out when you were blind and flying that thing?
I know what would have happened. I wouldn't have been here today. I don't even know if I would have been able to even hit the ground alive. The reason why I say that, I saw that firsthand, putting in a A-6, one of those Navy intruders. We were doing a mission one evening, if you want to call it that, and I said, hey, there's no friendlies here. Take random headings, you know, and everything like that, and I'll clear your hot when I see which way you're going. So about the second or third time, one of them kept going the same way. Pretty soon I saw one of his wings, his right wing, fly up over top of his canopy, and then just a few minutes later, both of them ejected. But I was on top of them trying to talk to them, and there was no response, no nothing. So as they were coming down, they were just a target. So, I know that's the reason I said, how do I want to do it? And I always told my wife that I will never be a POW. I will always either escape, or I will, but I'll never be a POW. And so that's the way I looked at it then, is I'm not jumping out. So the good Lord, like I said, the good Lord is with me at that particular time.
And the reality is, as you describe it, I'm thinking not only would you have been shot, your remains probably never would have been recovered. And your family might have even had unanswered questions still
mm-hmm.
today.
Because mm-hmm.
that's the reality for a lot of families still.
Absolutely.
All these years later.
Absolutely.
But you mentioned your wife, and she had her own war to fight back here in the States while you were over there risking your life. What do you understand now about what your young bride and young mom to a little toddler at the time was going through?
When I went over there, I also asked the Air Force, I said, hey, can you give me 30 days? My wife's pregnant with our number two child. Can you give me 30 days? And I don't mind going over there. I'm going to be here with my wife to have it. So now, 20 days later after go there, she's had the baby. I didn't see it until it was almost a year old. So with that being said, with the wife, I didn't realize a lot of that stuff happened. She didn't tell me. She didn't write me. She didn't let me know. I didn't know about it until afterwards. But also heard many horror stories about other families and stuff like that, but I didn't realize it happened to mine. But here in the local community, believe it or not, and I still shake my head, like a lot of other communities, once they found out that you were in, you know, were military and overseas in Vietnam, a lot of times if your family was around, they got harassed. And that's what happened to mine. Neighbors and stuff like that found that I was overseas and I was a pilot. They come knocking on the door at my wife's apartment to where she was at, and my little girl, my daughter, two at that time, and my wife went to the door, and they started saying, "Do you know your husband's overseas killing and maiming children and women?" And of course, my little girl, my daughter, Lisa, she looked up and said, "Mommy, is that what Daddy's doing?" And she says, "No," and she shut the door. Well, it got to the point that she came back one evening, and there was stuff written on the door, front door. And so that's when she called her mother and dad and says, "Hey, you know, I've got to move out of here." So they moved her out of there and boom, moved her to a new location. And she tried to keep that low key that about me being overseas. So I didn't find about that. I felt so terrible that she had to endure that, something that it was me. I really feel, you know, like I said, remember I was telling you about families and stuff like that? She still remembers that, and she still remembers how it wasn't pretty, you know, what was going on, especially trying to figure out why we were doing this, you know. So she had some trouble with it as well.
Right. So that really underscores, as we kind of bring this all to a close, your family's experience, your own personal experience, your wife's experience, that's a snapshot of what so many Americans went through. So again, as we look forward to April 28th and this Welcome Home Vietnam Veterans, where veterans, anywhere who's listening to this right now is a Vietnam veteran, is welcome to come to this and get 2 free tickets for it. What do you hope can come from this for those families, for those wounds that have lingered for so long that maybe even are still raw for some people?
You know, you would like to say, hey, this is going to make everything better. It's like taking an aspirin. You know, you'll feel better tomorrow. I'm hoping that the majority of the ones that come and be able to share is able to get something out of it. If nothing else, being with a bunch of individuals that has went through it too, and for them to understand that for a little while, we can be together, talk, laugh, kid. You might see people that you hadn't seen in many years from being over there too. But if we can just share and have a good time and be united with each other and understand and be able to say, hey, you are getting an official welcome home that you have never received over 50 years. Hopefully it will help, and maybe everybody else will understand and be able to move forward. And I'm also hoping that the family is able to get some type of a peace and a little bit serenity and be able to move forward too. That's my hope. That's why my wish. And maybe if you have to say it, maybe cry together for a little bit and then go on.
Well, I know we just barely scratched the surface of your long service to our country, but I want to say thank you for serving our country. Thank you for risking your life for us and for helping us understand by giving us that picture of what it was like to go through what you went through. Anything else you want to say?
No, I just want to thank you too, Paul, for giving me the opportunity to say, and if there's anything that I said here that might open up people that went through it, you know, the guys' eyes and understand it, hey, you did great. We made it home. And we won in the sense that we came home to our families, and we'll never be the same, but yet maybe we can be a little bit better than what we have in the past. And the families, I'm so sorry that you had to endure what you had to endure, but maybe you too can move forward and get a better understanding. And I just hope that the United States never allows this to ever happen again to a bunch of military men and women to go off and come back and makes them feel like worth something less.
Amen. And hopefully this welcome home on April 28th, 2018, will make every Vietnam veteran feel like something more. So spread the word. Let all the Vietnam vets in your life know that 2 free tickets are waiting there at whvvca.com. Again, that's linked for you at hometownheroesradio.com. Big thanks to Smokey Rickard, to Denise Baronian, and everybody involved in this team effort to, as Denise said, right a wrong and take a step toward healing some of the hurt that has lingered for decades. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that honor flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all, a reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they go into your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.